Welcome, everyone, to Wise Talk. This is Mariposa's monthly leadership forum. Today, our topic is networking and influence, how to manage what matters most. My name is Sue Beth Annis, and I'm the founder and CEO of Mariposa Leadership, and I'm your host today. And for Susie, it's tonight because she is in Washington, D.C., or Maryland. I am pleased that our guest today is Susie Pomerantz. She is the CEO of Innovative Leadership International. It's a Maryland-based firm which specializes in leadership coaching and business development. She is a master certified coach as well as author of the new book, Seal the Deal, The Essential Mindset for Growing Your Professional Services Business. Susie is highly regarded as a specialist in networking, marketing, and sales. She's also a close colleague of mine, so I'm thrilled that you have been able to join us today. So thank you so much for being here, Susie.
Thank you, Sue. It's really an honor to be part of Wise Talk.
And thanks for doing this at 7 o'clock at night.
You bet.
We'll be focusing today on, of course, networking, influence, and how to sell your ideas upward. There are three particular topics we'll be focusing on. The first one is your brand and now who you are and what you're known for. The second topic is networking and how we can make it easier on ourselves. And then the third topic is overcoming a bad rap or a bad reputation. If we make a mistake or something, how can we overcome that? A couple of housekeeping items. As usual, we have a full house and have a diverse group of people, both inside large companies as well as coaches and consultants. I know some of you are here just to listen and others will have questions. So after each topic, I will definitely call for questions. And I want to make this as relevant to each of you as possible. As a matter of decorum, I'm going to ask you to identify who you are to the group before you make your comments or ask a question. And I suggest if you are definitely on a cell phone and if you're in listening mood to put yourself on mute, and you do that by pressing star 6. And remember, if you do want to ask a question, you have to unmute yourself, so you have to press star 6 again. We are recording this session, and it'll be on our website. And, probably by next week and definitely by mid-April. So let's get started. The first topic we want to talk about is our brand. And, Susie, in your book, you talk a lot about branding and marketing. And what do you consider the first steps that we should take to figure out our own brand?
Well, you know, it's not like a step-by-step linear process to figure out your brand, but there are a number of places I can suggest that you start to look. And I don't think it matters in which order you look.
Okay. But some
of the things included in figuring out your own brand would be identifying your strengths. What are you best at? What is the highest and best use of your skills? Wow, somebody's got old music. Identifying your passionate purpose in your work or in your life, or what is it that is your. We will have lovely background music while we talk about branding.
Yeah.
but whatever your passionate purpose is in terms of what matters most to you, what you care about, where you can make your unique contribution, you know, each one of us has a set of a complex set of variables that includes expertise, experience, skill sets, strengths, interests, and so all of that combined with personality contributes to your unique contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And we might not always know what that is, so one of the other steps would be to seek feedback from colleagues, from family members, from superiors, as well as direct reports, looking at what am I known for? What am I best at? What do you think people come to me for?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one angle to take. Another angle would be sometimes I know people try to figure out what is the ideal image that I want to invent. How do I get known as the go-to person for something? Well, that involves doing a little bit of searching to figure out what that something is that you want to be known as the go-to person for.
Yeah.
But you can intentionally craft your image that way. And then the other piece of that is once you figure out how you want to be branded, you actually have to start speaking that new game, right? You have to start communicating from that place so that you start to get known in the way you want to be known instead of in your accidental brand, which is how many of us are known.
Mm-hmm. Accidental brand, I like it.
Yeah.
Because we have a brand. It just depends on whether it's explicit or if it's clear or not.
Or if we're even aware.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
Like, you know, we all have a brand, but are we even aware of how we're being perceived?
Exactly. And I mean, same with strategies. Like, companies all have strategies. It may not be explicit, but there's something there that they're operating against.
Right. So, you know, I would advise branding is not just for the self-employed or for corporations. It's for folks moving around inside an organization,
mm-hmm.
too, to start thinking about, you know, if I want to increase my visibility, if I want to lead through influence, if I want to be able to sell my ideas, I need to be known by the right people or by a lot of people for something. I need
mm-hmm.
to differentiate myself in my internal market inside the organization.
So you use the word differentiating. I think that that's important because the problem with brand sometimes is that it's the same old thing. There's a lot of people that have that same reputation or same competency, let's say.
Right.
But trying to differentiate us from all the other senior directors in the company.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about running a team? That's a little bit different.
It is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
With a team, most of the time a team is the victim of an accidental brand.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working with an organization's leadership team right now that was shocked to find in focus groups that they are perceived as antagonistic and the them and the us-them mentality of the organization. And they're really quite vilified by the organization when you look at the focus group data. And they were shocked to find that out, that was their accidental brand, that they had no idea. And the reason for that was that they never intentionally set about crafting how they wanted to be known as a leadership group. You know, they each had their own image as powerful leaders on the leadership team. But when they came together as a leadership group, trying to communicate a consistent message, albeit communicated amongst the different styles of the various leaders that make up the leadership team, there's still a consistent and aligned message that they want to communicate. So part of branding as a team has to do with alignment around that consistent message.
Right.
And it also has to do with really intentionally crafting what you as a leadership team want to be known for, not you as the CEO, you as the COO, you as the VP, you as the HR director, et cetera. So when you look at the whole leadership team and all the various senior vice presidents there, you want to look at what do we as an entity, if you figure that the senior leadership team is a separate entity, as if it is another individual on the team that needs its own brand to be identified and crafted intentionally.
Mm-hmm.
So one way to do that would be to start out through focus groups or interviews to identify what is the current brand.
Right.
Do some kind of a gap analysis to figure out if you start with what you want to be known for and then you do some focus groups to figure out your accidental brand or your current brand, doing a little bit of gap analysis there and then crafting the intentional brand versus the automatic brand and then everyone consistently communicating the party line, as it were.
Mm-hmm. So you're really differentiating between intentional brand and you're calling it automatic or accidental brand.
Right.
Yeah, I like that. Okay. So once we know the brand, so we've gone through some sort of analysis, whether it's a gap analysis or merely a couple of questions to our favorite people or our not favorite people, whatever. Once we know what that is and we've decided on it, what's the best way to spread the word on it in a way that makes sense?
Okay, so my flip answer to that is tell people.
Right.
But, you know, going a little more deeply, so something interesting happens when you try to shift a brand or try to intentionally craft a brand, because you've trained people up until now to see you the way they already see you.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of evidence to support the accidental brand or the up until now brand. And so if you're trying to consciously create a separate brand or a new distinction, whether it's about yourself or about the team, the trick is to have people start to see you consistent with the new
mm-hmm.
theme, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason for them to want to do that automatically. So you have to tell them that you want them to do that. You have to ask people if they're willing to see you through new eyes, if they're willing to see you anew. And as an individual, it's a little easier than as a group. As an individual, you can do it informally by saying, hey, you know, I'm working on some things for my own development or for my own promotability, or I'm managing my career from this different place and I'm looking to make these changes, and here's what I'm working on, and would you be willing to observe me over the next few weeks, months, you know, pay period, whatever, and give me some feedback about whether or not I'm starting to show up that way for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you're starting to create a listening amongst your audience, your intended audience, even if they're just coworkers,
mm-hmm.
of how you'd like them to see you anew. And then the secret to that, to making that happen, is really aligning all of your actions to
sure.
be consistent with your new image.
Sure, of course. Okay.
But to also continue asking people if it's working, you know, hey, I'm trying out a new style, is it working?
Or well, yeah.
And then also getting people, giving people permission to call you out on the mat if you're
well, right,
because
if you're going to ask them to look, you have to take the feedback. Because I think what I liked about what you said is that it's coming from a developmental perspective. It's,
right.
It's not coming from, oh, I want to get promoted, so therefore I want to change my brand.
Right.
That may happen, and that may be an intention, but it's not something necessarily that you put out there as much as I'm working on myself, I'm working on my career.
Or it may be I'm looking to improve my leadership skills, and one of the ways I want to do that is increasing my executive presence. So,
mm-hmm.
I'm working on my communication style.
Mm-hmm. So even though you're being, I think, direct, which I agree with, you're being direct with people, you're doing it for developmental reasons, so people can probably, it's palatable for people.
Yes.
Yeah. Because I think that sometimes what happens is that people are scared or anxious about tooting their own horn. So do you have any ideas about doing that without being obnoxious?
Yeah, I have to chuckle to myself because I remember working with a group of attorneys, and there was this lovely woman who was an attorney from Louisiana, so she had a very charming Southern accent, which I'm not even going to try to mimic because I wouldn't be respectful in doing so. But she stood up at a conference that we were doing, and she talked about how necessary it is for us to do shameless self-promotion, particularly as women in organizations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And people chuckled at the time, but there was a lot of resistance about shameless self-promotion. It sort of became a tag word amongst the group that I was dealing with. But I think that's what you're asking about. You know,
yeah.
How do I express my strengths and my skill set and my unique contribution in a way that doesn't look like I'm, climbing the corporate ladder intentionally or just trying to be a brat about what I'm great at. So it's not about bragging. If you can put it in the context of service,
mm-hmm.
or if you can express your strengths in the context of the stated commitment of leadership or the stated direction of the organization, then it's not about, hey, I'm great, look at what I can do. It's, you know what, I can really help here, given that our intended direction is to focus on results in this particular area. I have some experience there that I might be able to help.
Right.
With.
So I like the idea that it's in service to the organization or in service to the goals of the organization.
Or in service to the stated commitment of the leader.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times I work with individuals who are having difficulties communicating with their direct supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Or even with, a lot of times VPs will ask me to help them where they have trouble talking with the CEO about a certain topic. You know, and one of the things that it always comes back to is, well, what is the person that you're thinking is difficult? What are they committed to? And if you can get aligned with what they're committed to, you can express your request or you can make your comment or you can express your frustration in that context of being in service to their commitment, to what they're committed to. But it has to come from a genuine place. That's
right.
That's the other piece of it.
Cool. So shameless self-promotion.
Yeah, shameless self-promotion.
SSP for short.
There you go.
Okay, good. All right, so let's stop there. I really liked what you're talking about in terms of this distinction between accidental and intentional brand and doing shameless self-promotion. So let's stop and take some questions or comments. Remember to put yourself on unmute, so that's *6, to ask Susie a question. And really, the forum's open here, so whatever you'd like to talk about, go for it. Anybody have a question or comment? You're really, really clear. No comments, no questions.
This is Bill. I have a question.
Hey, Bill.
You said the forum's really open, so I wanted to skip over to your book, Susie.
Okay.
And the blurb that is on Mariposa newsletter says it's useful for a broad spectrum of business leaders, but the title is
yep.
Professional Service Businesses,
mm-hmm.
which is me. So mm-hmm. I'm thinking of getting the book, and is it aimed at people like coaches, or is it aimed at leaders?
That's an excellent question, and my clarification is that as I was writing the book originally, the original intention of the book and how it's organized was originally intended for coaches, but in the process of writing it, and let me back up a little bit there and say that It's organized around telecourse content from a 10-session telecourse that I did for coaches around how to develop their business. That's where it started. But in the development, going from the telecourse content, developing it into the book, I got a lot of feedback from early readers saying, you know what, this is not just for coaches. This is for anyone in any kind of professional services business. It would work for lawyers. It would work for chiropractors. It would work for consultants. It would work for trainers. And then the interesting thing that was a surprise to me was that after I finished writing the book, which was January a year ago, so it took from, you know, January a year ago until last October when it got published, I was applying, because I was so steeped in the concepts having written the book, I started applying it with my coaching clients. And what I found was the 10 steps that I talked about in Seal the Deal really applied with my clients who were looking to increase their visibility and really influence internally in their organizations by selling their ideas, mm-hmm. whether it was selling ideas to a board or whether it was looking to manage their careers and promotability inside the organization. And so, of course, that got me thinking, and I've already outlined book two, which is Seal the Deal Inside, which will be more direct to your point about is this really for leaders? Because by then, you know, the book was already published, and so yes, the title is misleading, but it is applicable both internally and for the solopreneurs.
Great,
thanks, Bill. Another question or comment?
Do you all have your own brand? Have you thought about branding yourself before?
Yes, everybody has, I'm sure.
Yes.
Do you want to take this time to – do you want to say anything about the book as far as some let's do some shameless self-promotion.
Nice segue, Sue.
Yeah, yeah. well, what I'd like you to do is talk a little bit about the steps, because you just talked a little bit about the book itself. So just say a few things about the steps, if you would.
Well – let me give a little bit more context.
Okay.
Because the real premise of the book, and it's kind of woven throughout the steps. So the steps in and of themselves aren't so critical. It's the mindsets and the themes that run, they're woven throughout all of that, is that there are three basic distinct domains that contribute to successful business development or sealing the deal, in whether it's selling ideas internally, et cetera. And that is networking, marketing, and sales. And that a lot of us have those commingled and are not clear on our definitions and distinctions between networking, marketing, and sales. So I spend some time in the book distinguishing between what each of those things are and then looking at that if you're taking action in each of those three areas, there's a sweet spot where action integrates around in all three of those areas, and that's the place where you seal the deal. So it's not just doing networking. You can get business, you can sell ideas, you can influence people just through networking and all the vehicles involved with networking. But it'll take a lot longer and is not nearly as predictable and sustainable as it is if you're integrating networking, marketing, and sales. Likewise with marketing, you can do just marketing activities, getting your message out there, but it's not going to be as effective or efficient time-wise as if you're integrating the networking activities with the marketing activities with the sales activities. So the 10 steps are really talking about how do you set your mindset and attitudes and belief systems in a way that are going to allow you to look at aligning activities in each of these three domains.
Love it. And we just talked a lot about marketing when we talk about the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be talking about networking here coming up. So before we do that, say something about sales. Say something about how that fits into certainly the sealing the dealing. It certainly has to do with closing the deal.
Right.
Yeah.
So sales is as distinct from networking and marketing is, so I describe networking as the relational piece of the puzzle, and marketing, so networking is about relation, marketing is about preparation, and sales, therefore, is about implementation.
Mm.
So sales is where you are engaged in activities that directly yield contracts, dollars, clients. It's a systematic process. It involves making calls, setting up appointments with the express agenda of finding out about the current issues that a prospect is facing. It involves prospecting. It involves proposal writing. It involves follow-up, moving people through a pipeline. You know, it's a system, right?
Yes.
It's a process.
Yes.
So the sales piece of it is, something that happens distinct from the networking and the marketing. A lot of people mush it all together, and that's why it seems somewhat mysterious.
Right. And they are mushed together because sometimes you're doing them not in order. But typically, networking, marketing, sales is the order, correct? Would you agree with that or no?
I think that it's more of a Venn diagram where you're doing all of them all the time at once.
Okay, cool.
I don't think it's linear.
Okay, so let's talk about networking, because I think that networking for many people is, I know when I talk with clients and I bring up the N word, they're just like, networking, oh yuck, they just seem like it's not in their body. Their body almost rejects it.
Right, because it seems like a phony thing where you're just collecting mm-hmm. business cards or handing out business cards or stuck at some event where you don't want to talk to people.
Yeah, or they have to go and butter up their boss if they're internal and meet somebody at a event for some sort of function at their doing the small talk thing at their work.
Yeah, the big schmooze, small talk.
Stuff,
yeah,
right. The meet and greets. Yeah.
Yeah, no wonder they recoil. I mean, those thoughts are reviling. Yeah, that's not what I mean by networking.
Okay.
So I'm glad you asked.
Good.
Yeah, networking, and I hate the word networking, but it's appropriate because it's work, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not net funning or net playing. It's networking. But networking are real. It can be fun, and the mindset shift around networking is that if you're involved in activities that yield human connection and interaction, not necessarily related to business, not necessarily related to any agenda, but that you are creating human connections, you
mm-hmm.
are connecting with others for many purposes, for the purpose of sharing resources, for the purpose of sharing information. Maybe it's about leads. Maybe it's about referrals. Maybe it's just about sharing ideas. Maybe it's just about connecting with another human being for no other purpose than to connect with another human being.
About where your kids go to school or something.
About anything,
yeah.
Right? It's just
mm-hmm.
about being in the world and talking to people. It's amazing to me how when we get caught up in how political different organizations are, that we almost lose we lose the joy of being connected as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, networking is about rekindling that. It's about, don't send an email to the person who sits in the cube next to you. Don't send an email to the person, down the hall. Get up and walk and have a conversation.
Mm-hmm. So what about those, you are a high, even if you're not an external motivated person on Myers-Briggs, you seem like you are. So let's just assume how I
am.
Okay. And so am I. So it's easier, I think, for externals to be able to network and get out there and small talk and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think for me, I tend to just want to be curious. I use curiosity as my sort of flag.
Yes.
What can you say for people who just, the idea of having to talk with someone on a regular basis is, and this even, they want to get down to it. They want to get down to what the topic is rather than having to do small talk. I mean, how can we overcome that?
Well, I have something that I put in the book that I talk to folks a lot about, which is called the 9 mindsets of networking.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be helpful to run through those?
Yeah.
In response to your question? Okay.
Sure.
So, the 9 mindsets of networking involve, the first one is that it's a game. Networking is fun if you stay open to it. And here's the thing, start with who you know. Start with who you're comfortable with. Stay in your comfort zone. Start with people you know and say, okay, I'm playing this new game and I'm calling it networking, and so I'm starting with you because I know you, I'm comfortable with you, and here's what I'm up to. Okay, so here's what I want to do either with my career, here's what I want to do with my business, here's what I'm working on, here's my development idea. And so given that commitment, who do you know that I should talk to?
Mm-hmm.
So that it then becomes a connection of a friend of yours or someone that you're comfortable with.
Right.
So that's the first mindset. The second mindset is to become a connection seeker. So if you're not already doing this, make yourself driven to find connections. So you want to be connecting people to each other. You want to be connecting people to information. You want to be connecting people into your life, including them in things that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about different ways to connect people and information and other people, and look for connections. Another mindset is about partnering. So looking for mutual benefit, looking for ways to serve, sort of that partner mindset from a service mentality. Keeping
partnering, you said?
Yeah,
okay.
like a spirit of partnership, right? Collaborative, helpful stance.
And by the way, for those of you who do have the book, this is on page 266 in the book.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So keeping agendas clear and stating your agendas up front is also part of networking. So like I gave in the example with number one, you know, when you're starting with someone you know and you're saying, okay, what's a good example? Okay, I'm developmentally working on improving my leadership skills, and particularly around being more collaborative. I'd like to learn how to be more collaborative. And so I'm talking to you first because I already know you. Do you have ideas for me about how I might be more collaborative? And by the way, who else do you know that I should talk to? Who do you know that's really good at collaboration who I could meet and pick their brain about that?
Mm-hmm.
So that you're keeping that agenda clear and you're stating that up front.
Right. Okay.
And that you're checking your assumptions, et cetera. The fifth mindset is curiosity about what's possible, and that goes back to what you were saying, Sue, about showing that genuine interest and inquiring what's important to other people.
Mm-hmm.
The sixth one is that whole concept of 6 degrees of separation. You know, if you intentionally wanted to network your way to get to any particular individual, I mean, let's say you wanted to meet, I don't know, Barack Obama or Britney Spears or I don't know who you'd want to meet, but chances are that you are within 6 degrees of knowing that person, meaning you probably know someone who knows someone who knows someone, you know, up to six to actually get to anyone that you would want to get to. So when you think about it that way and you keep it in the mindset of the game, it kind of becomes very intriguing to go, hey, okay, let's play a game called how many steps away from Bill Clinton am I, or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
How many steps away from the CEO of the company that I want to get a new job in am I?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you're constantly looking for those relationships, and another piece of this mindset is that every interaction is part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes back to, it's not just something that you're doing that you turn on the big schmooze when you go to an event, or that it's something that you have to do to move your career forward. It's really looking at every human interaction is a potential gold mine. You never know if the person that you just happen to be standing next to in line at the Blockbuster is, you know, who knows, married to the person that you're trying to meet. You never know these things. So keeping it as a game and in that mindset is helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And then really creating a comfortable atmosphere when you're talking to people. So, you know, using Stephen Covey's line about seeking first to understand and really recognizing that people do want to help you, but people also want to be respected and valued. And if you keep that in mind while you're networking, then it's more genuine.
Mm-hmm.
The last two are giver's gain and action. So giver's gain is the idea of, you know, service, again, coming from a service mentality. People really do want to help you. If you focus on helping them, it's all going to come back around. And then action is just staying in action. Networking is all the time. It's not just something that you put on when you have a purpose that requires networking.
Well, right, and that's why it feels, some disingenuous sometimes, because people do it because they're doing it just because they need something.
Right.
You do it all the time if you take what I call the Golden Gate approach, where, Golden Gate is constantly being painted, right? They can't just paint it when it's not orange anymore. They have to keep doing it. And so it's like you're always seeing the painters up on the bridge, and so you have to keep doing it no matter what. We used to have a group that got together called the Butterfly Connection, and we could tell how the economy was going, because when the economy wasn't great, we had more people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I use the example of doing dishes, right? You're never done doing the dishes.
Yeah.
There's always more dishes in the sink. You know, you finish them every night, and there's always more the next day. So networking is like that.
Yeah.
It's always there. It's never finished.
Yeah. Good. Okay. So, again, page 266, and on page 267, there's actually a checklist for networking actions, that a lot of which we've talked about. So that's great. I appreciate that list.
Yeah, and the checklist that you're referring to of the networking actions is really, if you've never networked, it's sort of how to get started.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a step. It's, you know, it's
great.
Spelled out in pretty simple terms how to start if you've never networked in your life.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's bring it to the corporation setting. What are some ways that folks can network with, let's call it, upper-level executives without appearing to be brown-nosing?
Well, first of all, it goes back to that genuine curiosity that we were talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the greatest ways to do it, the really great vehicle for that is informational interviews.
Mm.
And this is something that my clients are doing all the time inside their organizations. It's a homework assignment I give out all the time as a coach because it's such a powerful vehicle and it's such a simple tool. It's one of these things where you get a lot of great leverage and it's very low effort. Although some people, it's initially, there's a challenge, there's a mindset challenge to get over around it. But the concept is that you can target individuals, you know, once you learn about navigating the political landscape in your particular organization, you'll know who the players are that you want to target. So there are relationships that you need to build with key players who have political influence. And so if you look strategically inside your organization and figure out who do you want to have these relationships with, then part of what you can do to create the relationships, if you don't have any way of knowing these people, is to seek them out for informational interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And an informational interview is a brilliant model because you're not asking for anything other than a little bit of their time. But
right.
Even that, a lot of people feel as a burden because, oh, they're so busy, they don't have time
mm-hmm.
to talk to me, I'm asking
mm-hmm.
them to give me their time, and who am I, and why would they? But really, when you stop and think about it, people love to talk about themselves. And they love to think that they're helping you or mentoring
advice.
You.
They like to give advice.
They love to give advice, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they're helping you and mentoring you and talking about themselves, they're having a ball. So you're doing them a favor by asking them to give you this time because you're giving them a platform to talk about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But the informational interviews can be powerful in that if you follow the 80-20 rule where you're listening 80% of the time and you only are talking 20% of that time, you can really use your 20% to express your brand, to express your personal platform,
mm-hmm.
to really have this person start to know exactly what you want them to know about you in terms of your image or your capabilities or your strengths or your skill set or your intentions and aspirations for your career. So all of that. But what happens in the listening is that as you're listening, you're creating relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're talking about themselves. You're asking them questions about, you know, what has your career path been like? What are you committed to? What advice would you give someone like me who's looking to do X, Y, or Z in the organization?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever you want to know.
Mm-hmm.
I do a lot of onboarding coaching with executives, too. And in onboarding, the way we tweak that process is the executive who's being onboarded can ask target executives in the organization, you know, what do I need to know about the political landscape here? Who are the key players that I need to know? What is it that it took you 15 years here to figure out that you wish you knew when you started?
Yeah,
those kinds
I'd like
of
to take a pill so it only takes me a year instead of 15 years.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Great. I love it.
Right. So the informational interviews are a really great tool, and they're great throughout your career to manage your career in terms of guiding it in a strategic direction rather than a haphazard unfolding.
Well, the interesting thing about that word informational interview is that there's no question that when someone asks me for an informational interview, I definitely grant them it. But, you know, and it's code for I want something. It really is. It is code for that. I mean, however, I still do it because I think I like the idea of people it's not because I like talking about myself, but it's more that I like the idea of people asking.
And they're gathering information.
That's right.
You can't ask for an informational interview if your intention really is to sell something, right?
Yeah.
You can't ask for an informational interview if your intention really is to ask for a promotion. You know, that's not an honest agenda.
Exactly.
But if you're truly gathering information and you're looking to create relationships along that path of gathering
mm-hmm.
information, it's a great vehicle because it kills two birds with one stone.
Yeah,
it's a leverage point.
Oh, yeah, I like it. Let's stop there before we go into some situations about bad reputations and such. Let's stop there and open it up to the group. Again, anything is game. Any questions or comments to Susie? This is your chance to get some advice or make a comment.
This is Bill.
Hey, Bill.
Hi. I noticed you've mentioned the various pages you've talked about have checklists and so forth, and and you mentioned that it was drawn from a telecourse session.
Mm-hmm.
How is that now in the book? What's it like? It says, in effect, on this blurb here that we would have the ability to go through a telecourse with this book. How have you set that up?
Oh, well, I recorded the telecourses, several of them, and then transcribed the telecourses, and then integrated the telecourses so that to protect the anonymity of my clients on those telecourses, and then edited the heck out of it. And so each of those 10 core concepts and the 10 steps of the book, which were the 10 sessions of the telecourse, the actual transcripts that have been edited down to to the bare bones are in the book.
Uh-huh.
So for each of the 10 steps, you have the actual telecourse material. So you can see as you're reading the book, you can choose in the book to either go through all the telecourse material, which is followed by a lot of different checklists and templates and samples and things like that.
A lot of activities. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, lots of activities. You could use it as a workbook. It's sort of like a book within a workbook, a workbook within a book, and a teleclass within a book, and you can read it cover to cover if you want, or you can just skip around and read what works for you.
It's chock full of stuff.
It's full of a lot of stuff,
yeah.
And some
great.
People can't handle reading it cover to cover, so it also works for, depending on your level of sophistication, you could just flip it open and get really great review by whatever you flip open to, or you could just read the telecourse material if you wanted to feel like you were doing it as a course, or you could actually do it as a course and take 10 weeks and do a chapter a week, and read through the telecourse material and then do all the worksheets and activities.
Mm-hmm. Is that... help answer your question there, Bill?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Other questions or comments? Okay. So the third topic I wanted to address is a little bit different from certainly within the book, but it has a lot to do with influence. And it seems to crop up, certainly in the media. You have a lot of things going on now about people making mistakes and then copying to the mistakes. And there's people that are making mistakes and not copying to the mistakes. So I'm finding it very interesting lately to see who apologizes and who doesn't. So I thought we'd talk about it a little bit in terms of people that have less public figures or people who are in organizations, what to do. So the first situation is that let's say I engage in a 360 type process and get the results back, similar to what you had talked about with this team that you did a focus groups with.
Mm-hmm.
And to a person, I get feedback I'm not collaborative enough and I bulldoze my way through things. This has never happened to me before, but what do I do about changing that reputation? Because that's pretty intense feedback. And hard to change. So what can I do to help change our reputation?
Well, I have a very cavalier and flip answer for you. Collaborate more and bulldoze less.
Right.
but that's not what you were looking for, I'm sure. So, I think it has to do with understanding. First of all, there's a big pill to swallow
mm-hmm.
when you get that kind of feedback.
Right.
So it's understanding that there's something that you're doing or some way that you're showing up that's leading people to deliver this feedback. And so the natural response, I think, would be to be defensive or to be angry or to be embarrassed. There's a whole lot of emotional stuff that you kind of have to process through before you're ready to take action to change it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I would again go the route of informational interviews.
Mm-hmm.
I would start talking to folks and say, okay, I got to own up to the fact that I've gotten this feedback across the board. So therefore, there's something that I'm blind to here. And I'm going to trust that you all are seeing this because you're all giving me the same feedback. And what I'd like to do is ask for more information about what are some specific examples of things that I've been doing that led you to this assessment of me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think somebody's in an airport or something.
Yeah, because someone... there's some noise going on. Could you put yourself on *6, please?
So to change that reputation, part of what you do is make it explicit. Start telling people, I got this feedback. This is something I'm committed to changing. I'm going to make mistakes along the way of changing it. I don't necessarily know how to change it, but I'd like your help in figuring out how to change it. I could use more
mm-hmm.
specific feedback. I'd like to ask you some more questions. I'd like to gather some more data from you about what I'm doing, what are the situations, how it's showing up, so that I, you know, so then you can start to look at some specific behavioral changes that will allow you to come across in a different way, the way that you intend, you know, and then you go back to designing how you want to show up
mm-hmm.
and aligning your actions consistent with how you want to show up, and then requesting that the people around you start to see you through new eyes in that new way.
Mm-hmm. So this is an example, I think, is back to the original question we talked about in terms of branding. It's sort of like the on one end of it, you actually go in and get that feedback, and it turns out that what you're known for is more intense and more divisive than you thought.
Yeah.
And so trying to shift from what you have been known for to what you want to be known for.
Yeah, and that is your brand, by the way.
Yeah, yeah,
even if
definitely.
It's bad news, that
oh, yeah.
is your brand.
That's what
right?
I mean. That's what I mean.
Yeah,
and
so
and it might be accidental, but it's also negative.
Right. And so to
yeah.
change it to a positive brand, you have to first have some clarity around what you want that to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to figure out how you're going to get there. And then you have to figure out how you're going to retrain everyone around you to see you differently. Because they're not automatically going to start. This is the breakdown point I see in a lot of organizations, where people work really hard to change, they've taken the feedback to heart, and they've done all these things to make changes, and they sort of just expect people to notice. And then they get frustrated when people are still reacting towards them as if they were the old way.
Exactly, and because it takes a lot of notches for people to get it. You can't just do it one time. They're
right.
going to have to see it more than one time.
Well, and the other side of that, too, is that even if people are willing to see that you have moved the needle and you are making changes, then oftentimes what happens is, you know, you can be doing great with your new behaviors consistently 9 out of 10 times, but then that 10th time, you revert to your automatic previous mm-hmm. behavior, and people kind of throw up their hands around you and go, oh, well, look, he isn't fixed. He's back to the way he was before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so part of engaging people in the dialogue about your own development and that you're going to make some mistakes puts them on notice in a way that you're not going to be perfect and that you want to be acknowledged for those 9 times that you did, that you were on the right track and not be written off for the one time that you, you know, fell back into your old habits.
Right.
And that
right.
it's a process. It's a growth process.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Here's another situation. So someone is telling my customers or my boss that something that's really untrue. What are some inroads to solving this type of issue?
So I'm trying to understand that one. So there's something that occurred, or they're saying something about you?
Yeah, something about. I mean, I don't want to get too specific, but just as a general rule, somebody's gossiping, or
okay,
maybe they're pissed off and they are making stuff up.
They're making stuff up. So
yeah.
slander is happening.
Yeah.
So the first thing to do is rise above it, because you definitely don't want to engage in point counterpoint about
yep.
stuff that's not true, because there's
yep.
no one's going to win there. That's a he said, she said kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it has to do with relational sophistication, too, and really looking at the context of where it's happening and why. And a lot of it is around awareness and sophistication of how you can navigate best in your political landscape in which this is happening. So I think there's a lot of different answers.
Depending on the situation.
Depending on the context, depending on the organization, depending on the politics, depending on the individuals involved. I mean, if it's someone who you respect a great deal, who's saying something that's untrue, you might want to find out why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe there's a conversation you could have if you have sufficient relationship with that person.
You could go to them directly.
You could go to them directly, right? Mm-hmm. But if it's someone who, I don't know, maybe it's someone who's mentally ill and nobody in the organization knew it yet, and you know, I don't know. I mean, it could be any extreme.
Well, it could be. I think a situation that is probably more practical, or you know, well, not practical, realistic, is that somebody who you don't have a great relationship with for a myriad of reasons,
mm-hmm.
And it's an okay relationship, and they're spewing things, something that is definitely untrue. They had never done that before, but they're saying something that, and so you can't necessarily go to that person, and you don't want people to think that you're, you know, she said, he said thing. You don't want people to think that you're defensive.
Right.
That's
but you want to set
the record straight. Yeah,
yeah.
But that's where I think it gets to be tough.
Yeah. Because how do you set the record straight if you can't go to that person?
Right. Right.
I don't know. I think I would probably attempt to go to that person anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And say, you know, I understand that you've been saying this, and I'd like to find out why you think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I would give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe
yeah.
they actually think it's true. Maybe
right.
they don't know that it's untrue.
Right. Good. Okay, I like that. So the last one has to do with what I was talking about before about mistakes. So do you have any ideas around, or what are your ideas around, so this is kind of the opposite situation. You do actually make a mistake, and you cop to it. So how what are some ways to cop to the mistake?
Is the concern that would negatively impact your brand? Or the
Oh, yeah.
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 So taking full responsibility. When you do make a mistake, it's a matter of integrity. And, you know, a simple apology, while it feels embarrassing, can go a long way towards being your word, you know, and really managing your brand. See, that's the other thing. Once you intentionally craft your image that you want people to have of you and you've started retraining people into your new brand, then you have to manage your brand. You have to manage perceptions around your brand. And that's where these situations come up, is as places that could potentially derail your progress in managing your brand effectively. So I think anytime you honestly made a mistake, you cop to it as quickly as possible. You minimize the risk and the exposure, and you move on. You fix it if you can. If you could make it whole and repair the damage done, go for it. If you can't, apologize profusely and let it go. Move on.
Yeah, I think, and there's this sort of fine line between what I've noticed in the public domain is that you apologize, but also don't blame others, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, taking responsibility means, you know, if it's someone on your team who made the mistake and you're the supervisor, you're in charge of that team, you own it.
Right.
You
right.
take responsibility. Yeah, you don't ever want to scapegoat or point the finger to somebody else.
Okay, good. So let's stop there. Any questions, comments, final thoughts as we wrap up here for Susie? Any situations similar to what we've been talking about that are either close to home or because you noticed that you're in or someone else is in? We have a quiet group today.
Yeah.
Well, this is Bill, and I'm just take advantage of this since nobody else is. I was waiting.
No problem.
Well, I would like to ask you, Susie, about the whole process of creating the book, because I'm in the midst of wanting to do that, and also out of a teleworkshop that I already have.
Ah.
Yeah. So I was just wondering, did that process work for you, transforming
yeah.
a teleworkshop into a book? Did that?
That was,
yeah. You're the first person I've known to do that, maybe others, but I just haven't chased after this idea before.
Well, for me, it was one of those accidental, maybe it would work if I try this kind of moments where, and I'm really thrilled that I pursued that line of thinking because that really made the whole process much easier. Once I had the telecourses transcribed, and those came back to me, and I started the editing process of those. I basically started writing my book from the telecourses. So originally, I had 100 pages of book before I even wrote a word. And so starting from that, I was able to edit that down and then build it up with the rest of the text and worksheets and stuff. So I would recommend to anyone, if you're thinking of writing a book and you've got anything recorded that you can transcribe, that's absolutely a much easier, much faster way to write a book than starting with a blank screen.
Okay.
That's automatic content.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was very easy.
Mm-hmm.
Because the telecourses themselves took many, many, many months of development and then even more months of implementation, the actual writing of the book was very fast once I had that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great.
Good.
Yeah.
Thanks for answering that one. I'll be encouraged.
Yeah, good.
Any other questions?
Yeah, this is Ken in Boston. Hi.
I
wanted you to know there's more than one person on the call.
There's 23 people, so I know.
Yeah, this call has been loaded with great information. So I have a question for you because, you know, the very notion of branding suggests that you emphasize some things at the expense of other things. And when you make yourself the go-to person for one thing, almost by definition, you can't be the go-to person for everything. So to put this in the context of coaching, I find that I work on a wide variety of engagements.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them involve onboarding new executives. Some involve high-potential people that are looking for promotion. Some involve troubled executives that don't want to get fired. I mean, there's a pretty wide range of assignments.
Sure.
And I have some concerns about casting myself in too narrow a niche.
Well,
and I
that's
just wonder how you feel about that.
That's an excellent question, Ken. I'm glad you raised that. Because I would say that even though that's a wide variety of engagements, there's probably something that is a unique contribution that you as a coach make in each of those engagements that is unique to you. And I'll give you an example. For me, as an executive coach, having done this for 14 years, I've done everything from training to facilitation, onboarding coaching, high potential coaching, executive team coaching, you know, all across the board, a lot of the same things that you're describing situationally. And when I went through my own exercise of identifying my brand and how I wanted to be known and how I wanted to be differentiated as a coach, it's not so much about the kind, you're not differentiating yourself by the kinds of engagements that you're doing. You differentiate yourself about what is your unique contribution within those engagements. So one of the things that when I started seeking feedback from my clients, across the board, the pattern that emerged was people were telling me, you know what, you bring a certain level of clarity that I've never had before. And so I started thinking about myself as a clarity hound, and then that evolved into my brand, which is that I help leaders and organizations find clarity in chaos. Mm-hmm. So it evolved from looking at what's the common element, what's the common thing that I'm bringing into each of these engagements, even though, you know, because for me the diversity of the engagements is part of what I love about this business. Mm-hmm. I get bored very easily, so I would get stagnant if I was in the same kind of engagement over and over again. But what I'm passionate about and what really energizes me is the business of finding that clarity point, you know, helping people muddle through all the chaos and the overwhelm and getting to clarity. That really juices me. So there's something in there that's uniquely you, that is the thing that Ken brings into every coaching engagement.
Right. So that which is common to all engagements at life.
Well, that which is uniquely Ken.
Right.
Or uniquely Ken's coaching, you know, because if you take, you take 600 coaches who all have, even if they all have the same coaching methodology as their primary methodology of use within the coaching context, their personalities and their experience and their cumulative package as they apply it to that coaching methodology makes them unique and different. But it's a matter of how do you articulate that.
Right. Good. That's a good answer. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks, Ken. Well, I'll add that you've been extremely clear on this conversation, so I can see how you are with your clients. seriously, I mean, your answers are very I've been doing this for 2 years, and different people have different answers, and your answers are very clear. So I appreciated it. Last chance for questions or comments, and we're gonna call it a day here.
You know what, Sue? That's actually another good point. If for those folks on the call who are looking at working on figuring out what your brand is, mm-hmm. once you figure out what it is, you're going to get that kind of feedback when you express it. You know, like I just talked openly about what my brand is, and Sue's like, "Yep, I see that in you." So you kind of hear that back from people.
Good point.
Yeah,
we're trying to walk our talk here.
Yeah, right.
Good. So let me do some promotion for you. The book Seal the Deal is actually on sealthedealbook.com. It's also on Susie's website, innovativeleader.com, all one word, innovativeleader.com. And what's your email, Susie, in case somebody wants to email you?
It's Susie, S-U-Z-I, at innovativeleader.com.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. This has been another great Wise Talk, and as I said, especially clear and cogent, and makes it easier for people to listen to. So I will end by saying, please, everyone, tell your friends about Wise Talk. You'll be able to get Susie on our website, MariposaLeadership.com, probably by April 4th, I want to say. And tell your friends about Wise Talk. Our next Wise Talk is Alan Weiner. He wrote a book called called So Smart But. So we'll be discussing how being too smart gets in the way of getting good work done. And Wise Talk will be a different time and date. It's going to actually be April 27th. It's a Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Savings Time. So we needed to move it for his schedule. So it's not our typical Thursday at 4. So everybody, please tell your friends and colleagues. We've really appreciated everything you've done to continue this. We're always having full sessions, so we continue to appreciate the community because that's what really makes this work. Thanks, Susie, again, and have a wonderful evening, and see y'all, hear y'all next time. Bye.
Thank you, Sue. Thanks. It's been an honor to be here.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
I hung up on you?